We have a great panel here, and we're going to talk about what EPA is doing in terms of addressing carbon pollution and cleaning up traditional pollution, ozone, and particularly ozone. So I want to introduce my panel. I have on my left, I have Richard Alonso, who is with the Environmental Strategies Group at Braswell and Giuliani. He's a former EPA Air Enforcement official. Next to him is Vicki Patton, General Counsel for the Environmental Defense Fund. And then we have Bill Becker, who's Executive Director of the National Association of Clean Air Agencies. And then at the end, we have Vicki Arroyo, Executive Director of the Georgetown Climate Center at Georgetown Law School. And these are great sources. If they're not on your source list, they should be on your source list. And they have, they're very much involved in the discussion on reducing greenhouse gases, and many of them on the traditional regulatory programs EPA has as well. I want to first start out, let's talk about the EPA's proposed rule to regulate emissions from existing power plants. And I would like Rich to give us a sort of a very brief rundown of that program, and then we're going to have Vicki Patton and Rich talk about some of the, turn to Vicki to talk about some of the legal vulnerabilities of that, and then have a little bit discussion and move down the table.
Okay, great. Good morning. Thanks for having us. Let me take five, maybe a little bit, no more than 10 minutes.
Five minutes
on introducing the proposal. So I'm going to summarize, you know, thousands of pages of regulatory preambles and text in 5 minutes. But basically the Clean Power Plant Rules, what EPA is calling it. You'll also hear it called the 111D rule, which is the actual section under the Clean Air Act that is used to promulgate this proposed rule. Basically what EPA did was that they looked at all the states and they put a carbon dioxide limit on each individual state. Basically, you'll hear the term called budgets, you know, CO2 budget or whatnot. But basically, all states except for, I believe, Vermont and Washington, D.C., have limits on carbon that must be achieved by the first phase in is 2020, and the second limit, there's a more stringent limit that comes in 2030. You guys let me know if I say anything wrong. The key thing is when EPA, that's the regulatory requirement. So it's very hard for us to say as lawyers and people coming to us and say, well, what does this mean for my particular plant? It's you don't know the answer of it because the states then develop a plan on how they meet that limit. And based on that, that's how individual plants are going to know whether or not, what is it that they have to do to meet those limits. But in the proposal, we can kind of assess how EPA came up with those numbers. And basically, there's four buckets, or pillars, as folks are calling them as well. The first is that they expect the existing coal-fired power plant fleets to perform efficiency projects at the coal-fired units that will increase the efficiency by 6% at each of these units. The second is they... EPA developed these numbers by assuming that the states will change the dispatch order of how electricity is being sold. Right now, the dispatch order for electricity is nuclear goes first, because when you have a nuclear plant, you turn it on, you can't turn it off. Then you have coal, and then you have gas. And mainly it's based on price. What the EPA proposed standards contemplate is that the PUCs, the public utility commissions, and different state agencies that regulate dispatch of electricity would switch the order so that gas will go first and carbon will go second, third in the list. So therefore, your first generating asset that comes online is gas and then coal. The third pillar is, and it's a kind of a, I thought it, I was expecting more, but they do expect a lot of renewable sources coming online in the near future. And the last pillar is basically, And this is the one that folks are really focusing on. Well, they're focusing on all of them, but this one in particular is EPA assumes that they will be a efficiency of 1.5%, an increase in efficiency of the electrical users on the consumer side, that will happen 1.5% every year. What that means is basically that, you know, these gas-fired power plants, these coal-fired power plants, their product that they sell is electrons, right? Basically that the states will develop programs or utilities or somebody is going to develop a program that reduces the demand for electricity. And based on those four pillars, they developed a number for each individual state.
There are a number of legal claims that some of the opponents of EPA's proposal have made. One of them, central legal arguments, is already being litigated. And that argument goes along the following lines, that the agency fundamentally lacks authority to regulate power plants, fossil fuel fired power plants, under the provisions of Section 111D, because it also regulated these power plants under the air toxics provisions of the Clean Air Act, Section 112. And there's this parsing of the applicability language in 111D that some of the opponents are seizing on to say, well, when Congress overhauled the Clean Air Act in 1990, it made some adjustments to it strengthened the air toxics provisions. And in recognition that it was strengthening those, it made some changes in the way the 111D applicability language reads. And we're going to argue that on the basis of that text, that Congress made a radical, fundamental shift in the way it has long regulated under Section 111 of the Clean Air Act, and it deprived EPA of authority fundamentally to regulate any source category that is also regulated under the air toxics program. And that's wrong. That's wrong because the statute has long read and long been interpreted, including post-1990 by the Bush administration in one of its major rulemaking initiatives, to understand that Section 111D is about protecting human health from air pollutants. That is what it's about. And it fills and it reflects sort of Congress's judgment in 1970 and has long been administered and interpreted and carried out this way, that existing sources are oftentimes regulated under the health-based air quality standards that we'll talk about, that what we call the National Ambient Air Quality Standards Program. And existing sources, beginning in 1970, were also regulated under the Air Toxics Program. But there is a category of pollutants called designated pollutants, or the category of pollutants that might fall between the gap, that would be discharged from existing sources, and they could cause harm, health harm, serious health and welfare harm. And so Congress said, you know, we're worried about that, and we know we've got these health-based standards, we know we have the air toxics program, and we need another program to ensure that we're not missing something. And so they sent staffers back in the middle of the night, 1970, to craft this language, and the language that was passed overwhelmingly in 1970 and been administered this way ever since says it's about the pollutants. It's about the pollutants. It's about protecting health and welfare. And EPA has clear authority to regulate these pollutants that might cause harm irrespective of what source category they come from, so long as those pollutants are not regulated under the health-based standards, so long as those pollutants are not regulated under air toxics. That's how we protect human health and the environment. The other, and right now there are 11 states that had filed a legal challenge against EPA's proposal, and this is kind of the centerpiece of their legal argument. There are many reasons that legal challenge is not going to succeed. One is because it's a proposal. Courts have long and often stated, and the Clean Air Act reads clearly in a way that provides that you can only file a legal challenge against final agency action. Right? So we're in the middle of the public comment period. EPA is in the middle of policymaking, working on this. And so courts don't want to interfere. Congress has clearly said when you review an agency decision, you review it under the Clean Air Act when it's decided, when it's finalized. And then they make this argument about EPA sort of exceeding its authority. There are two other legal arguments that are being made real quickly. One is that the delegation to EPA in establishing these standards is a delegation of rulemaking authority to determine what is the best system of emission reduction. People talk about BSER, best system of emission reduction, and that EPA, in determining what is the best system of emission reduction for fossil fuel-fired power plants, can only consider what can be mitigated at the plant. And it's really unprecedented for EPA to consider sort of mitigation, some of these building blocks that Rich described that happen outside of the plant, like shifts in utilization. And the counter argument to that is very compelling, and it goes something like this. Congress didn't say that. What Congress said, it's never used the word technology in the context of 111D. It hasn't ever said to EPA, you're limited to technological solutions that happen at the plant. And what Congress said is do what's available, do what's the best, do what's cost-effective. And all of these building blocks that Rich described are happening, in fact, in states across America. They're being deployed by power companies across America. They're available. They're cost-effective. EPA has relied on them in designing and determining what is the best system of emission reduction. And further, this is exactly how EPA designed the cross-state air pollution rule, which was just affirmed overwhelmingly by the Supreme Court in a 7-2 decision on April 29th. The building blocks of the cross-state rule included the following. EPA said we're going to set a state target. We're going to set a state target under the cross-state rule for, in that instance, sulfur dioxides and oxides of nitrogen on the basis of plants running control equipment that they're not running, because there are some plants that have been idling their control equipment, plants deploying modern pollution controls, and big shifts in utilization across the system from higher emitting to lower emitting units. And that was affirmed by the Supreme Court again at the end of April. And then the final argument is that this is EPA commandeering energy policy, that EPA has somehow overreached in some untenable way and is kind of controlling and dictating energy policy across America. And that's an argument we've heard many times before under the Clean Air Act. The reason EPA is regulating power plants is because power plants are the single largest source of emissions in our country. They're one of the single largest sources of carbon emissions in the world. And so you can't address and make any progress in addressing greenhouse gases and climate change if you don't regulate power plants. And regulating power plants, their emissions, doesn't mean you're setting energy policy. It means you're protecting human health and the environment from the emissions that a big source within the energy sector is discharging. There's a long, long history under the Clean Air Act. We can talk about it, where states have long integrated energy policy into the air quality planning and management because it's one of the ways you mitigate emissions. So states have incorporated, states like Texas, city of Shreveport, Virginia, Maryland, have integrated things from building codes, energy savings programs, RECs, into the air quality planning and management at the state level that EPA has approved for many years. Western governors recommended that EPA incorporate renewables and energy efficiency into EPA's regional haze program to protect visibility in national parks. EPA did it. The Bush administration in August 2004 issued a blueprint on how you incorporate renewables and energy efficiency into the nation's air quality planning and management. We have a long, long history under the nation's clean air laws of integrating clean energy into air quality planning and management, because it's the way you mitigate air pollution in a cost-effective way, and it's the way the states have done it, and the states have really asked EPA to do it. And you really fundamentally can't protect human health and the environment if you're not also regulating fundamentally the emissions from big energy-producing facilities. Thank you.
Can I have that one back? You guys use the link. Okay, so Bill, will you give us... a perspective from the state regulatory sense and what the challenges the states face in pursuing this type of program or opportunities.
Okay, well, thanks. So I'm Bill Becker. I direct an association of 42 of the 50 state air pollution control agencies and 116 of the 117 local air pollution control agencies around the country. And of course, all the states think alike. But I'm going to try to do my best to give you a general consensus of what I think those 42 states are thinking generally about this program. And I'm going to surprise you because there has been a significant outcry by Congress and by at least 11 of the states regarding this program and their criticism of it. And what we are seeing, not at the political level and not at the gubernatorial level, but in the trenches, is that there is a huge and aggressive effort ongoing, even during the proposed stage, to make this program work. The states that are suing are still engaged in discussions with their colleagues, both on the regional scale and on the national scale. We have calls. We had a call on Thursday on one piece, on one of the bins that Rich discussed, something that was not nearly as sexy as some of the others, renewable energy, and we had 132 agencies from around the people's lines used from around the country. Many of them shared the same line. There is a tremendous amount of interest in making it work. And we've seen sort of this precedent set 3 years ago. I don't know how many of you followed a similar program on greenhouse gases dealing with permitting of sources. And then 3 years ago, there were a dozen governors suing, and at the same time those governors were suing, those same states were engaging constructively in making the program work. Why would they do that? Well, they were doing it because their industries were telling them that they would be at a competitive disadvantage if they decided to oppose the program and not adopt the necessary legislative or regulatory infrastructure that was needed to issue permits. They would be at a competitive disadvantage in expanding their operations. And so fast forward to today, there are going to be some winners, there are going to be some losers in this program. And I think many of the stakeholders understand fully that, notwithstanding some of the political rhetoric and some of the other opposition, it's incumbent upon them to be involved from the outset. Let me just spend a couple minutes identifying some of the, notwithstanding what I said, some of the issues, some of the constraints, some of the opportunities that exist. This is a complicated rule. I mean, it's many, many hundreds of pages. It's not entirely written in that there will be blanks to be filled. There will be questions that need to be resolved. And EPA, like the states, are continuously learning how to refine this to make it work best. It is somewhat unprecedented in that it's a piece of cake for the states to generally write state implementation plans for the traditional air pollutants that Vicky mentioned. It's a little more challenging to write plans. They're not really called state implementation plans. For greenhouse gases, for existing sources, we have some experience with regulating existing sources under this program, but not with greenhouse gases, and it's going to take an entirely new effort. The interesting part of this, and one that you probably, if you've reported on this, have examined, is once EPA develops the rule, they sort of stand out of the way, and it's entirely up to the states to put together a plan that meets EPA's criteria. And EPA's and the states' plans, probably without exception, will differ from state to state. There will be no plan that looks alike and Gina McCarthy on down has said that same fact, that we don't expect any two plans to look alike. There may be some multi-state opportunities. And let me just identify a couple of one other problem and one opportunity, and then I can turn this over. This in many respects, I hesitate to say this, but in many respects is not unlike the Affordable Care Act, in that it is a huge domestic initiative of the president's. It will affect every state in the country and have an impact potentially on most citizens. It is complicated. It will be, costly but not overwhelmingly expensive. And there are people who do not want to see this work, including some in Congress. And the House in particular has pushed through legislation or trying to constrain successful implementation at the federal level. And they have cut state grants to run this program at the state level. And like the Affordable Care Act, without sufficient resources, it's not going to go as well as we would like. And this is a problem. The big difference is under the Affordable Care Act, we can debate whether the rollout was sufficient. Under this program, I've been doing this just in this association for 33 years, and I've never seen an effort by any federal agency totally unprecedented in putting together the kind of network and discussion and opportunities for states to provide input as we've seen in this program. And EPA, by and large, is listening. They're listening carefully, and we think by the time they issue the final rule, they will get it right. They will improve it a lot, and it will minimize the level of opposition. And then one final point about opportunity, because we're going to be talking about the National Ambient Air Quality Standards in a second. To the extent that we are successful in reducing greenhouse gases in this program, it will have a very significant impact on our success in reducing sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, and smog-forming emissions, because when you conserve resources, you're reducing pollution. And that has been reported, but it's going to be very significant in regard to the collateral benefits of both programs. And with that, I'll turn it over to Vicki.
I know you want to respond, Vicki, but can we wait for Vicki Arroyo to give us a little more context to the what the proposal is about?
Sure. Well, just maybe pulling back a little bit from some of the detail, I was just going to try to reflect on how we got here for people who might not follow the day-to-day of the 111D story, as the wonks among us want to call it. And I think that's important because, you know, as you've heard, based on some of the rhetoric that you might hear that has gotten picked up in the media, you know, EPA is overreaching, EPA is trying to fit this elephant through this mouse hole. But if you step back and look at how we got here, to the point where we're trying to regulate emissions from the largest source category, as Vicki Patton says, this actually started in the 90s, where various groups, including some small NGOs, were petitioning EPA under the Clinton era to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. Looking at the, you know, old traditional, good old standby Clean Air Act, they said, you know, you've got the authority, why aren't you doing this? And so this has played out over decades. Simultaneous with that, many of us, certainly me with my former hat on at the Pew Center on Climate Change for 10 years, was working more in a parallel track to try to get Congress to pass something like, you know, comprehensive climate legislation, cap and trade bill or something like that. But these lawsuits were percolating, eventually the Supreme Court settled this issue as to whether or not EPA can use the existing authority, since we, you know, weren't making a lot of progress on the congressional side, affirmatively with Massachusetts versus EPA back in 2007, and since, as you've heard from Vicki, has really reaffirmed that EPA should be moving forward, especially given that they made the endangerment finding when this administration came in 2009. But what happened in this window of many, many years where there was federal inactivity was that the state started to actually just do something, started to demonstrate some progress, started to do it for their own economic development reasons as much as anything else, including the majority of them putting some kind of renewable portfolio standards in place, requiring a certain amount of their electricity to come from renewable sources, energy efficiency measures that kept the energy use in a state like California flat while it grew 50% in other states, while growing their economy dramatically. This has happened in a number of other states as well. States in the Northeast joining forces in REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which, you know, I can testify when they were first putting that together, they probably didn't think that they'd be around today and that there wouldn't be a federal program that displaced it yet, or at least built on it, like we see California's AB 32 and so many more, Colorado's Clean Air Jobs Act. In the meantime, the Bush administration, of course, denied California's waiver when they asked to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, not because this wasn't big enough of a problem, but saying it's too big a problem for a state to handle, ironically, even though they weren't willing to make an endangerment finding. So then again, in 2009, the Obama administration moves forward with an endangerment finding, starts to commit in the international negotiations, and we're seeing some talk about this, of course, with Climate Week coming up, to the targets that are in the federal proposal at the time, the Waxman-Markey bill. And of course, even with the failure of comprehensive climate legislation to get the reductions that were being contemplated in that legislation, this administration has said we can meet those targets through a combination of the existing authority that we have under the Clean Air Act, EPA's authority that has been affirmed and reaffirmed by the Supreme Court, and building on these state programs that actually have gotten us quite a long way, including the California CARA standards that moved forward and became federalized under this administration, another important sector, emissions reduced, state action in a variety of ways, the natural gas switching that we've seen with the natural gas boom, and now looking at power plants. And so, you know, I would just say, just stepping back a little bit, providing some context, that in spite of a lot of the rhetoric and the drama around this, the way that EPA is proceeding builds on what the states and many power plants across the country have been doing. We did a report at the Georgetown Climate Center last year capturing some of the success stories at reducing carbon emissions from this sector and showing how it's been done already and how we can build on it. We have something that you might find useful on our website called the State Energy Analysis Tool, or the C tool, that shows you what has been possible in each state, what their renewable opportunities are, what their efficiency opportunities are, what they would get if they joined a cap and trade program like REGI. And so far from being, I think, an overreach that we've heard about, we actually believe that this action is required by EPA, that the way they're doing it really, as Bill says, listens to this really broad outreach effort that they have had, listening to the power companies who've already made these changes, want to be recognized for the changes that they've made, listens to the states that have been leaders, builds on that, and is long overdue, frankly.
Okay. Why don't you add what you were going to do? And I have one question about this before I want to move on to the health-based standard.
Oh, you do too. Under the Clean Air Act, the architecture is a state and federal partnership, and that is kind of woven throughout many of the Clean Air Act programs, and it's the way that 111D is also designed. And Bill mentioned that there may be some states that litigate and at the same time carry the program out. And in the context of the construction permit program for greenhouse gases, which is one of the very first programs EPA administered climate protections for stationary sources, this construction permit program and this requirement that at the time of construction or rebuilding, you deploy modern pollution controls for greenhouse gases and other airborne contaminants because it's an efficient time to do it. You integrate pollution controls at the same time you're making these major capital investments and design choices in your facility. And that program, Texas, really led the attack on EPA in every respect, politically, in the courts, and was really just sort of adamant that, you know, EPA didn't have authority to do this, and certainly that Texas itself was not going to administer this program, and it fought in the courts for some time. In 2013, after years of saying to EPA, we are, you know, not going to administer this program, and EPA saying, okay, that's your choice, you don't have to, but we do have to protect human health and the environment in Texas, and so we, as EPA, we need to put in place federal measures that are backstops and that protect human health and the environment, and they give industry the certainty they need that they can have a compliant program. And so after that cycle unfolded in Texas in 2013, Texas gave itself authority through the state legislature to administer the construction permit program for greenhouse gases because the business community said, you know, this is a requirement, and we want Texas to carry out the law, and we want to be working with our local, our state and local air quality control officials in carrying this law out. We don't want EPA to be running the permit program, the construction permit program in Texas. So let's figure it out, and let's get our authority in place, and let's work with EPA and our state and local officials to get this done and to get authority. And so, you know, and the flexibility and the incentive for states to participate is much more extensive in this program because Rich described the building blocks and these four building blocks. Those four building blocks only establish a performance standard. That's all they do. They say, here's the carbon intensity number, performance standard for your state. You states have complete latitude, complete discretion to design a program that meets these carbon intensity standards. And that's why Bill was saying on this phone call, all these states and you know were engaged and how and why no single state program will look the same. Because states are really free to mobilize any number of solutions, including many that aren't within the building blocks, to achieve that carbon intensity standard. The other just factor here is the timing. And there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, look, EPA finalizes these standards in 2015. States have up to as long as 2 years to develop and submit their programs. That means 2017. You know, we have an intervening presidential election. You know, will this program kind of really move forward? Well, a big change earlier this week on Thursday when, you know, Hillary Clinton, representing, you know, the potential presidential candidate in one party, said in Nevada, you know, climate change and clean energy innovation in America, you know, matters, and we want to lead the world. And that's an important part of this discussion, and that is, that, you know, will whoever's, you know, leading EPA and occupying the White House in 2017 carry this program forward? And that, you know, a big at least signal from one party in the last couple of days that, yes, this we will.
Sure. I'll give the industry perspective now that everybody else has talked. No, just a couple of things. I mean, there's the legal arguments that the lawyers will make, whether or not there's authority, and, you know, as Vicky was talking about, and those are going to be played out in the courts. And then there's the whole, you know, politics, you know, Republicans, Democrats, we shouldn't be controlling carbon or whatever. And then where we focus on a lot, at least in my time, is, all right, guys, how does this work for us? How is this going to play out? And I say us, my clients who are in the energy business. And they're looking at this from, okay, what does this proposal do, or is it realistic? I think, you know, Vicky said that historically EPA has dove into these type of, you know, energy efficiency programs and everything else, but I think we'll all agree that this is a pretty, from you know, I've been doing this since 1996, these guys doing it, you know, longer or the same, whatever, but this proposal is really something new that the environmental community at this high scale, we've never seen anything like this from EPA. But if you look at those pillars, you know, 6% energy efficiencies. If you're a coal-fired power plant operator, and if you can do a project that will increase the efficiency of your plant by 6%, I guarantee you, you would have already done it. Okay, because that means more money for you. You're producing your product, your electrons, at less cost. Okay. Second thing is the change of the dispatch order. Well, you have a lot of these PUCs, right? And well, the PUCs, a lot of them are, their authority comes from state constitutions or state legislatures. And their mission is to provide reliable and cheap or cost-effective electricity to the consumers. That's why coal right now is going before gas, because it's cheaper. The electricity is cheaper from a coal unit than it is a gas unit right now. Well, how do you change that? Well, the way you change is you put a price on carbon. So really that second prong is really to put a price on carbon, which is, you know, a cap and trade program. It could be a carbon tax. It'll be up to the states to figure that out. unless you change the mission of the PUC, which that would either need a state constitutional amendment or change of the legislature to actually change the directive of a lot of these PUCs. Renewable markets are going to happen. When it's cheap, it should go forth. And you know, let me just say, there's no such thing as a cold, on the large scale, there's no such thing as a coal-fired electric utility in the country right now. Everybody who burns coal burns natural gas. They, you know, you look at the Southern, you look at the AEPs, you look at the big power generators. You know, everybody's diversifying their fuel. And coal is on its way out. There's no doubt about it. And they recognize this. But at the same time, they have these assets and they produce electricity and they want to maintain them. And then on the energy efficiency side, the same thing. A lot of these programs, you know, fluorescent light bulbs, energy efficiency programs, we have been doing this for years and years. A lot of that low-hanging fruit has already been picked on energy efficiency. So when you start looking at, you know, those increase of energy efficiency 1.5 across, you know, the entire economy, then people like our industrial clients that have cogen units or manufacturing plants, they're worried about, gee, wait a second, what is this going to mean for me? I'm a big user of electricity. So is there something in this rule that is going to be imposed on me? And they don't generate coal fire. They don't generate electrons. They use electrons, right? So in order to meet that fourth pillar, you have to go to the supply chain. To the demand change. So from a practical standpoint, people are really struggling. The other thing on the states is you go back, and you folks are from all across the country, keep in mind, some states are winners and some states are losers in the sense that this rule it means something to some states and nothing to others. As an example, Washington State. The Washington State budget has a decrease of carbon by something like 70%. Well, it just so happens that there's a coal-fired power plant in Centralia, the TransAlta plant. They've already agreed to shut down that plant by 2020 or 20 at some point. So for Washington State, yeah, it's a huge decrease of carbon that they have to achieve by 2020, but it's already in the books. So really, it's not that big of a deal.
From Washington State, yeah. It's just worth noting that they get a lot of power from Montana. 40% the largest utility gets 30% of its power, but it's counted on Montana's budget.
Right, and that's the other thing. I mean, the electrons do cross state lines. No. I know. But then I'm just using it as an example. Some states, it's going to be easy to meet their targets. Others, it's not so easy. Texas is a prime example. And one of the reasons why Texas gets so up in arms is really what do they feel is the impact to their state economy. If this didn't have much effect to the state economy, Texas wouldn't be going, you know, crazy suing EPA on all these greenhouse gas rules. But anyway, on Texas, they're requiring the state of Texas, probably one of the most industrial state in the country, to reduce its CO2 emissions by 50%, you know, by some drastic amount in such a near term. And the state of Texas is looking at that and saying, well, there's just no way. And when you talk about carbon emissions are directly tied to economic growth in the sense that the more economic growth, our carbon emissions have gone down. Yeah, during the whole recession period, yeah, our carbon emissions were down. Now economic growth is coming up, the economy's changing, carbon emissions are going to be probably going up. But you know, there have been a lot of improvements on the efficiency side. So thanks.
Okay, we'll have a lot of opportunity to take questions from everyone. So,
Bill, I know you're chomping at the bit to say something.
Can you do it quick?
I'll do it quick. So Rich has made some interesting points, and I think that he is correct that there will be some states who will be able to meet targets more easily than others. In no state that I know of will it be terribly easy. Maybe in Kentucky, a coal state, it will be very easy, but not, you know, overwhelmingly easy. But the point I want to make is about the opportunities that exist, and you were pushing back a little about how it's going to be very difficult for some of these industries to meet the energy efficiency targets. We are developing a menu of options and a model rule to help states meet their targets. And we publicized this just a bit before we even started. And we have had about 30 to 40 meetings of industries, possibly your clients, who have come to us and said, please put, you know, our opportunity in your menu of options. Please acknowledge the opportunities and the resources that we can provide to meet this federal program. The smart industries will take advantage of it. The industries that will fight, I think, are going to lose the opportunity. So is it going to be easy for everyone? No, but the alternative is to do nothing more on greenhouse gases, and that's not an option. So I think, you know, one final point, reducing greenhouse gases is going to make things more efficient and vice versa. If you increase energy efficiency, you're going to reduce greenhouse gases. It's going to reduce criteria pollutants, and it's going to make things cheaper in industry operations.
This is a discussion that could go on for a long time, but I'll save some of your once we get to the end, you can ask more questions about this program. What I want to get to now is that EPA is under other litigation, is required by December 1st to unveil a proposal to strengthen the ozones, the federal ozone standards. And if each of you could talk briefly a little bit about the impact of this, particularly, you know, what the challenges the states face with a new standard like this. I mean, I live in California where we haven't met, you know, long time ago standards for ozone. And industry says, you know, we have the best technology in the world and we can't reduce our emissions anymore. So if you could just talk a little bit about the importance of these standards. I know, Bill, you were going to get a little context versus standards versus limits. So why don't you start that off?
So I think you all know this, but the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, whether it's for ozone or fine particulate or for other traditional air pollutants, is not a limit on industry. It's a limit on the air you breathe walking outside your building or your house. So it doesn't directly limit pollution. It provides the structure for industries and other sources like vehicles to limit their pollutants. So it's not a direct correlation. But I do want to put this in context. There are 30 to 40,000 people who die each year from fine particulate and, to a lesser extent, ozone. 30 to 40,000 people die each year. We know today that in 10 years, we are going to have approaching 500,000 people who die unnecessarily because of air pollution. And while this discussion we really had was very important, and the president's proposal was really important, and all the state efforts that Vicky outlined are very important, and the press is reporting very well on those, I guess, you know, my personal chagrin is that statistic of the number of people dying prematurely, which is more than any other environmental program that I know of, possibly radon is the more than radon, and it rivals most social domestic programs, non-environmental, in this country. And the reporting from the environmental perspective, and this is not a criticism, it's just an observation, is mostly on climate. And the activity amongst the NGOs is mostly on climate, not on this. And the resources that are going at the government level is mostly on climate, not on this. And while I would never for a second suggest having less resources for climate and less reporting on climate, this program, which is threatening public health, is kind of the dirty health secret. It's getting short shrifted, and we know again today, we can predict that many years from now, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of people who've died unnecessarily. And so one final point on this, when the only thing we can ask for from EPA, I think, fairly, is for them to follow the science, for them to revise these health-based standards, which Congress says should not take into consideration costs. They can when we implement the standards, but not in deciding what the standards are. When revising these standards, you should follow the science. And what Congress did, which was really smart many years ago, is it developed something called the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee, a committee of independent scientists, including industry, and tasked them not with writing the new standard, but with making recommendations to the administrator of what the standard should be. And what this group said, KSAC for short, was that the ozone standard, the smog standard, should be tightened and set at a range between 60 and 70. So right now the standard is at 75 parts per billion. The scientists are saying it should be strengthened to 60 to 70. And EPA and states should follow the science and be supporting that. This is going to be a very difficult implementation experience for the states. I know this. It's going to be tough politically for the president because he's going to be asking a larger number of states and non-attainment, newly designated, newly identified areas exceeding the health-based standards to have to implement this program during presidential election year. And yet, this is what the science is demanding, and this is what, if we truly want a national ambient health-based standard, then this is what should be done.
Okay. Do you want to say something on this, or go to Vicki? Okay.
The scaffolding of the Clean Air Act and establishing these national ambient air quality standards provides for EPA to set the standards on the basis of human health, and then the states to consider economics, cost-effective solutions when they're developing their air quality management plans at the local level to achieve the health-based standards. And this question about EPA establishing these standards on the basis of health has gone to the Supreme Court, and it was decided in an opinion written by Justice Antonin Scalia, and it was a unanimous Supreme Court in 2001 that said yes. When Congress used the term public health and delegating to EPA the responsibility to set these nationwide ambient air quality standards, it said to EPA, make the decision solely on the basis of human health. And it's anchored in a very elegant explanation. And that explanation is that we ought to be honest in America about whether the air is safe to breathe. We just need to be honest. And we ought to, you know, we look at the very best science that's available. And we try to, and it's a really remarkable process. It's probably one of the unique processes that happens in our government at the kind of cross currents of science and policymaking, where you have this independent science advisory committee look at a body of information, make recommendations to EPA on the basis of science, and then EPA synthesizes that and makes its own sort of judgment that undergoes public comment. But it's all about sort of making this science-based determination about whether the air in our communities and neighborhoods is safe to breathe, and trying to be as transparent as we can about that, recognizing there may be a debate about whether the solutions are cost-effective. The last time the nation's health standard for ozone was updated was in March of 2008. It was revised by Stephen Johnson, who was serving as administrator in the Bush administration, about 2 days after he made that decision. A couple things happened. There was a front page story in the Washington Post indicating that literally like the night before the decision was announced, EPA was instructed by the White House to remove all of the information about the environmental effects of ozone. So EPA sets two standards, the health-based standards, and then a standard that's also designed to protect against environmental effects, welfare effects, and that was stripped out. And then the other thing happened about 2 days after that decision was made was the National Academy of Science issued a major report that EPA had been involved in, finding clearly for the first time that ground-level ozone, smog, tropospheric ozone, is associated with mortality. And one of the leading researchers is a woman named Michelle Bell out of Yale. She was on that panel. There were a bunch of other folks on that panel. But it came out a couple of days after EPA and the Bush administration made that decision. And EPA's decision in March of 2008 really diminished the importance of the link that was subsequently revealed between ozone and mortality. The other big health effect that's really at stake here is children's asthma and children's lung disease. And the body of research that's emerged since 2008 has only become stronger in terms of the connection between ground-level ozone and asthma attacks, but more than that, long-term lung disease. So if you're a child growing up in an area that has unhealthy ozone levels, then you may have your lung functions altered, you know, for your whole life. It's not, and not only are you, you know, susceptible to asthma attacks, which are tragic in their own right and serious, but you also may have a lifetime of very serious lung disease. So there's a lot at stake, and there are also important solutions. We talked about the Clean Power Plan. We talked about the co-benefits. One of the single largest sources of ozone-forming pollution is the NOx that's discharged from power plants, and EPA's really designed this in a way to enable the states to secure the co-benefits that you mentioned, Carolyn, that often come with the interplay between climate and human health. And so if you're a state, you have every pathway to design your clean power plan in a way that optimizes reductions in oxides of nitrogen from power plants. The other major growing source in America of ozone-forming pollution is oil and gas. And it's the volatile organic compounds that are discharged from oil and gas in large volumes. And when Colorado put its landmark methane rules into place in February of this year, there were two elements of that. It was the nation's first limit on methane from oil and gas, supported by three major oil and gas companies. And it was also a limit on the volatile organic compounds from the oil and gas industry. And it's incredibly cost effective. There's so much the oil and gas industry can do to mitigate methane, to mitigate volatile organic compounds. That is just extraordinarily cost-effective.
Well, that's a nice segue. I wanted to talk about the EPA's plan for methane, which isn't really targeting oil and gas operations per se, but just sort of a generic methane. Am I right? And that I know EDF has been involved in the whole methane program. So if you could talk a little bit about what the administration is looking at for methane and the
process. So building upon the President's Climate Action Plan that was announced at Georgetown in June of 2013, the White House, carrying out the President's commitment to address methane, issued a methane strategy in the spring that lays out this very kind of data-driven approach to addressing methane, which is a potent climate forcer. And there's just been, and very few people have told this story, and that is that every time the world scientists look at the global warming potential of methane, it increases, it rises. It is a potent climate forcer. So in the most recent report issued about this time last year from the world scientists, they adjusted upward in a very, very major way the global warming potential of methane on both a short-term basis and over 100 years. And so if we're serious about addressing global warming, there is a crisis. There's an urgent need to mitigate methane. So the White House laid out this data-driven strategy that looked at the major sources of methane in our country, oil and gas, the top emitter, agriculture, second, and landfills, third. And laid out sort of a decision-making framework for addressing these sources. It made clear, it was pretty manifest in the blueprint that it was not going to regulate through regulations a methane that's discharged from agriculture, that it was going to be all through voluntary partnerships with the Department of Agriculture and with the agriculture industry and lots of voluntary measures there. But it also said we are going to move forward and make a decision on the potential for mitigating methane from oil and gas for five major source categories. And in one of the top discharger within the oil and gas industry is really the leaks that come kind of throughout the system. And so they called that out. The White House also identified pneumatics. You have these high-bleed pneumatics that can be replaced for just very, very cost-effectively and to low-bleed pneumatics. Compressors, something called liquids unloading, and then looking at applying green completions or reduced emissions completions that mitigate methane when you're producing a well for oil and gas well production in the same way EPA had established similar standards for gas-only wells. And the data indicates that if you do that, if you mitigate from those just five activities within this extensive oil and gas sector, that you can reduce methane by 40% for just almost entirely payback. It's like, you know, a penny. It is so incredibly cost effective. So EPA's issued white papers, detailed white papers that look at each of these five emissions activity sources within the oil and gas sector. They've undergone peer review this summer. That peer review process has just been completed. EPA looked at all of the emissions data for methane and VOCs and benzene from these five emissions activities, cost effectiveness, technologies, and then on Tuesday of this week, the administrator of EPA gave a speech at in New York City at the Barclays CEO Energy Conference, where she said to this set of investors and CEOs, we need to work together to mitigate methane from oil and gas. We need to address this. This is an urgent problem. There's just, you know, manifest solutions, and talked about just the path forward in doing that. And so, you know, decisions are really being made right now about whether what next steps look like. This is an important story. It's happening right now. It's unfolding. The debate is you know, clearly underway. I urge you to take a look at the administrator's remarks on Tuesday, where she laid out her strong commitment to moving forward and addressing methane from oil and gas. What's critical is what does that look like, and will it be meaningful in protecting human health and the environment?
Okay, we have 15 minutes left. Did you want somebody? I wanted you questions, Okay, all right, 2 minutes for you and then questions. I forgot to mention that EPA did release, I believe it was late last week, before last, staff recommendations for the ozone standard, proposed ozone standard, proposing to keep it from 60 to 70 parts per million rather than the 75 it is now. And there's hundreds of pages there for your fine reading. Okay.
Go ahead. Just really quick on the ozone standard. There's probably no such thing as a safe level of ozone. I mean, it's an irritant. It screws up your lungs. You got to get it out of the air. Where the administration sets the limit, whether it's 60 or 70 or whatnot, they're going to set the limit. And Vicky and Bill are correct. The courts have spoken. You don't consider cost. You just consider health. And they turn to the science community for that. The key there is the implementation. What does this mean for different states, different local areas? Permitting is a lot more difficult. It's a lot harder to expand businesses. It's a lot harder. So there is a political component to this. It may not be a legal component. It may not be, you know, everything else. But just the fact that the scientists have given a range of 60 and 70, that kind of indicates that there's some political judgment within EPA to pick somewhere in that range, at least. So anyway, I mean, the ozone standards or any NAAQS standards, it's going to be what it is. It's going to be challenged, but that challenge is very, very difficult given the existing case law. And, you know, it really comes down to implementation. And as Caroline said, there's areas in the country that haven't met their standards since, you know, 1976 or when this, and it's an amazing program. No doubt about it. The NAAQS program is if you look at the Clean Air Act and you look at public health benefits, you know, it's all from the NAAQS program.
Okay. Okay, so now we're going to take questions, and the SEJ rules are journalists first. If there's time, we'll turn to non-journalists, and journalists and SEJ members have blue tags versus yellow tags. Or red tags, I see. I see some other, I don't. Okay, let's go with Sarah first, and then we'll do, and please introduce yourself.
Sarah Terry Cobo, the Journal Record newspaper, Oklahoma City. I cover energy. So I kind of have a reporting question, actually. Bill, you mentioned that people don't cover, you know, premature deaths. But my question for you is, I have a statewide focus.
As much as they should.
As much as they should. Okay, so help us then. Help us. How do you find those people who have died prematurely from air pollution? How do you localize air pollution to a state or a city or a neighborhood level? Because that's what's compelling about this story is the deaths and the asthma attacks. And how do you find that?
So I have no idea how to find the people dropping on the street, and they're not people dropping on the street. But these are studies that have been done by Republican administrations, not just Democratic administrations. Christy Todd Whitman, when she was administrator, you know, came up with this figure on her watch, and even if the figure is off by a factor of 10, because there's a lot of slop in the, you know, probably in the analysis, and I'm maybe not giving enough credit to the analysis, it's still an overwhelming amount, and it's an unacceptable amount. So I don't know how to make it juicy. Maybe visit some hospital rooms, look at some of the records how people died, and take a look at some of the talk to some of the pediatricians, some of the doctors, and see what they are saying. I just know that from a macro sense, it's huge, and I don't know how to make it more local. It's a very good question.
Okay.
Vicky's
going to answer.
Yeah, Vicky. The other Vicky, yes. Oh,
Vicky's.
Sorry. I mean, I'm sort of one of the people that Bill mentioned, I guess, who shifted my career from air toxics and conventional pollution, where I worked at EPA and actually here in the state of Louisiana before now working on climate change. So sorry for that. But it is near and dear to my heart when you're talking about things like air toxics, which in this area, you know, it's a substantial problem, this kind of chemical stew, for those of you who've seen that tour upriver, and the ozone and other conventional pollution. And, you know, one thing is asthma doctors in the area, the American Lung Association in the area, right. These tend to be the advocates at the State House. A person that I worked with years ago on the bill that reduced toxic air pollution by 50% in 4 years done under the Romer administration when I worked in his DEQ was Kip Holden, who's now the mayor of Baton Rouge, who had really compelling stories about grabbing his girl and rushing her to the hospital, not knowing if she was going to be able to breathe and live. You know, so public health officials in your local medical schools or schools of public health, you know, and then obviously you can look at the data more broadly, but you can find some compelling stories, I'm sure, wherever you are.
Just add briefly, Moms Clean Air Force. There's a group of moms that's gone from 0 to 350,000 moms in a span of 2.5-3 years, and it's military moms, it's conservative Christian moms, it's Latina moms, it's moms all across the country of all different perspectives and backgrounds who are united by protecting clean air for their kids. And so Google Moms Clean Air Force.
And I'd also recommend checking your local air quality agencies, local universities that are doing that have experts that are doing studies, or look elsewhere. California has a lot of public health data on air quality impacts.
Bobby McGill, Climate Central in New York. Two quick questions. This one is to Vicky Patton. With study after study, seem to show that there are more and more leaks in the methane in the oil and gas distribution system, and we really have no idea how many leaks there are, and there could be it's just impossible to quantify them at this point. How is the EPA going to be successful in cutting back on methane emissions? And second, to William Becker and Rich Alonzo, the EPA seems to be very opaque in explaining exactly how each state's energy portfolio sort of fits into the four buckets, and how they reach each individual state's goals under the Clean Power Plan. I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit more in more detail, comparing Texas to Washington, and what specifically led to that particular goal for each of those states.
And try to do it briefly, please.
So there are a number of state programs that have been put in place to try to mitigate oil and, emissions from the oil and gas sector that regulated these five, in different ways, these five emissions activities that EPA is looking at now. And it's a combination of equipment, cleaner equipment, replacing out, again, high bleed pneumatics with low bleed. That's just our no bleed pneumatics. It's just equipment. It's maintenance practices, changing out your packing on your compressors, totally low cost and can, you know, mitigate the leaks. And then it's, and then it's, you know, critically instrument-based leak detection and repair. And that is really the centerpiece of the Colorado program. And that is, you know, we have technology that is readily available, cost-effective, and can reveal the leaks. I don't know if you've seen some of those instrument-based monitors. And one of the realities, it's not only, you know, are they, you know, becoming, are they, you know, available for the design and government programs, but we're in a world where every American is going to have a monitor. They do. They have a monitor in their pocket, right? And so, you know, as these technologies become more and more accessible to all Americans, more democratized, it's going to change air quality policy across America. It is. The Sierra Club put a camera in Kentucky on a pond and showed over time illegal discharges, right, into a pond from a power plant, a coal-fired power plant in Kentucky. The world is changing, you know, as these technologies become more and more democratized. But, you know, you can make integrate instrument-based monitoring into the policy, into public policy.
Okay, really quick on methane, I think it's actually a good story where industry, environmental groups, regulatory agencies are working together. EDF in particular has been very active, engaging industry in trying to figure this out. And the interest there is when we talk about methane emissions from oil and gas systems, you're talking natural gas. You're talking product, right? So it's an industry's interest to try to capture as much of that natural gas as possible so that they can sell it. It's also interest for the state regulatory oil and gas industries because more natural gas is now passing through the royalty meter, right? So they can get more royalties for the oil and gas. So just keep that in mind. I think that, that will play out. The folks that are pushing back, if any, you know, maybe not some, hopefully not sophisticated oil and gas companies, but the problem with the pushback from industry on that is they're out building new stuff. All the new stuff is going to have state-of-the-art, you know, collection of methane because they want to capture their product so much. The challenge there is, how do we retrofit the old natural gas well that's been there for 30 years that's leaking steam? Well, then that's not, I don't know about the site, but that shouldn't be happening. You know, if that's the case, then somebody's building bad wells, and that needs to stop. But anyway, energy efficiency. Yeah, actually, you know, on that, on how these state plans. I mean, Bill, they're working with the states. You're probably better positioned to talk about how you guys are doing it.
So, you know, quickly. I don't know if I'd call it opaque. They do have this technical support document that goes over, you know, very clearly what they're trying to do. So it's not opaque. It's confusing, and I don't think they're trying to hide behind the formula.
Well, they won't talk to me about it.
So,
that's a big thing about industry, right? Is that the public record is not 100% available. They have monitoring them, but they don't.
EPA uses what's called the IPM model that they used under the CARE rule, the CASPER rule, to look at these issues at micro level. And in those rulemakings, they have made those modeling runs available to the public. For some reason, I don't know why, but the IPM runs under this proposal. EPA is refusing to give that to not only to you guys, but to us. So
let me just say that we're going to have another 132 on a call this coming Tuesday on this very issue with EPA staff. And so if you have a question, email it to me. and because they have been as open as they possibly can be to us. I don't know what kind of setup they have with the press, but if you have a question, if any of you have questions, email them to me, and I'm assuming they're legitimate, and I'll see that they get asked.
Just real quickly, one of the best resources I found on this is there's a recent Congressional Research Service report that was issued about 3 weeks ago, and what it did is it took all of the voluminous sort of technical support that EPA's produced, and it included in appendices in a very, you know, pithy CRS report how the building blocks apply in each state. So it disaggregated and said, it's an 8% reduction in this state for heat rate improvements. It's all disaggregated, and then it adds it up into sort of the final sort of emissions performance standard. So it's by state.
Okay. Chuck Kornbacher, Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Wisconsin had several counties that went from non-attainment to attainment in the last couple of years based on the 97 standard. How does it work if the ozone standard gets further reduced? Or could counties be back in non-attainment? What's sort of the general process? Maybe Mr. Becker to begin with and others?
Yeah. So, good question. To the extent that the ozone standard gets tightened, then in essence, it's moving the goalpost back a few more yards. But the progress that the running back from the Packers has made... has made to advance the ball and to get closer to the initial goal is still very important progress of reaching the final destination. It will mean for every area that is currently non-attainment, if the standard as expected is strengthened, everything they're doing now will continue to be done and then some, but they'll be given more time to do so. For areas that are clean, that are in attainment, where a new standard puts them in non-attainment, they will begin the process, like those other states, of developing a brand new SIP. And for states that have gone in and out of attainment, it becomes a little more daunting because they have to go back and forth. And that's why EPA averages attainment over a three-year period and makes sure that the measures that are adopted are enforceable.
Okay, I'm going to do two more questions after this one.
Hi, Tony Barbosa, reporter at the Los Angeles Times. I want to ask again about the ozone standard. And, you know, there was some mention of the science advisor's recommendations to tighten the standard, and then just last week the staff EPA recommendation, which came out on a Friday, right before Labor Day, you know. Maybe 5 o'clock West Coast time. But I wanted to ask you about the administration's reluctance to talk about the ozone issue. You know, this year they've really been out like touting the Clean Power Plan and the health benefits of that. But, you know, given what Bill just said about, you know, the incredible health consequences of air pollution as it exists now, who are the winners and losers, you know, of tightening the ozone standard, and why is the administration not out there advocating for this in the same way they are on climate pollution?
Anybody?
Yeah, sure. and just really quick. I mean, I think, you know, you have the science. You can't consider costs. At the end of the day, it's a very highly political decision. I mean, when Lisa Jackson wanted to propose a new standard, you know, something that I don't think I've ever seen, you know, you had the White House step in and say, no, you're not going to propose this new standard. This was back in, 2011, 2012, maybe. It's just a very political charged issue because you're impacting state governments. You're impacting mayors. A lot of those mayors and states are Democrats. You know, whether you're a Republican administration or Democrat, it's just very, very political. And that's, I think, and then you got the midterm elections coming up. I don't think they want to highlight this because they don't want to, you know, it could really mess up your political strategy in a lot of localized areas.
Okay, go ahead. Hi, I'm Hal Burnton from the Seattle Times. I had a question. I guess perhaps Rich or Vicki Patton might answer this. Basically, I was wondering, as you look at the legal arguments that the states have filed, and you mentioned several of them, which is really, in your mind, like if you were defending against or whatever, would be the strongest one that seems to carry the most weight? And do you think that these lawsuits are all sort of perfunctory? Of course, it's going to happen. I mean, not this round, but the later round, once it's finalized. Or do you think there's real legal issues that might, despite the Supreme Court ruling, tie this up?
Vicki?
I think the legal challenges that have been filed now against the proposal will not be successful. There was a similar legal challenge filed against EPA's proposed new source standards, new carbon pollution standards for new power plants. That was dismissed by the same court as premature. And it's just, you know, the Clean Air Act is very clear. You need kind of a final agency decision to challenge that. Will there be extensive litigation? Yes. Right. Will there, you know, under the Clean Air Act, that litigation has to get filed in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. That's required by statute. It's that court is it's like a, you know, has tremendous expertise in administrative law and these other federal environmental laws because it sees a lot of these cases. It's also a court whose composition has changed in the last year and a half. You'll remember that court, there was a 3-judge panel of that court that stayed the implementation of the cross-state rule and ultimately was reversed by the United States Supreme Court in April. Since that decision was made to stay the cross-state rule in that 3-judge panel of in that federal court of appeals, there have been 4 new judges nominated by the president and confirmed to that court. And so the court itself has changed, and you also have EPA acting in an area where it enjoys a lot of deference because it's acting on the kind of the cutting edge of its own kind of expertise, and courts tend to defer to that.
Okay.
I think as to the lawsuits that are currently pending, you know, why did they file those? I don't know. It seems like they file 6 of them a day. It seems on the proposal. But I agree with Pat, and that I agree with Vicki that from a legal perspective, I mean, it's a proposed rule. You have a really hard uphill battle to convince a court that it should get involved so early in the process. On the legal arguments that I kind of feel are kind of the strongest ones against if the EPA proposed rule went final, and keep in mind, anytime EPA does something, it's going to get sued, right? Whether it's by industry or environmental groups, right? I mean, that's just the way the environmental business works. Okay, we get clients all the time. Oh, we don't want to sue EPA. I'm like, they're so used to it. If they don't get sued, that would be uncommon. I think the strongest legal argument is this idea that EPA is from a legal perspective. Going too far beyond the fence line, trying to change the energy mix, you know, the dispatch order, energy efficiencies. I think there's a lot of vulnerability in there, especially in June. The Supreme Court issued an opinion in the UARG decision, which had to deal with greenhouse gas permitting. And in that, there's a lot of language, and granted, it was from Scalia, that basically it's almost like he read that proposal and said, you better watch out. You cannot don't overreach here. Don't try to, you know, the tentacles of EPA get into the economics and how people use electricity and whether or not you need to turn on your lights at this time of day or that time of day. So I think maybe from a legal perspective, it's like if you textbook, but the judges are people too. And they kind of, it just seems like that is a really big time vulnerability at EPA.
Area that they're trying to regulate
Right. That basically, the legal argument would be this, that a 111D, the statutory provision that deals with these standards, is the base of these standards, require that technology be installed at a particular plant, right? As opposed to all these other amorphous energy efficiency, you know, renewable, going beyond the stack, right? The Clean Air Act regulates stacks, you know, it doesn't regulate the marketplace. And what this does regulates the marketplace. We can differ on kind of the strengths and weaknesses, but from my perspective, EPA might have done this in the past through voluntary programs or even regulatory programs, but it's something that's never been presented in such a way before a court. So,
okay, I'm going to take one more question, and we've got to move on
out. Okay, my name is Stephanie Sal. I'm with Argus Media, energy reporter based out of Washington, D.C. Bill and I have talked before, thank you for being here, about the menu of options and the model SIP that you're working on. I didn't know if you could provide an update on the model SIP since we last talked, this summer. Has that moved along? What kind of feedback you've heard on that plan?
It's moving along. We are using someone now from Louisiana who used to work in Vicky's old place, DEQ. We are making progress, but it's too early to share any reports of progress. But we expect to have something completed in the next couple of months, well before EPA's finalization of this proposal.
Okay, I want to thank our panelists and thank you guys for asking great questions.